Royal Society of England discussing aliens? Surely you just, Governor. That really is pretty wild and certainly historical. Dr. Michio Kaku is my guest. I'm Art Bell for George Norrie, and in a moment we continue. Once again, Professor Michio Kaku, Dr. Welcome back. Yeah, so, Pandora, that world was such a wonderful world. Everything was connected, and there were no satellite dishes, no radio, no television, none of that stuff. Trees and flowers and beings that were all connected with each other. How likely is it that a society would form that away instead of one that would transmit for us to hear?
Well, I actually discuss these kinds of questions on my website. Once again, it's mkaku.org, M-K-A-K-U.org. And I'm on Facebook. You can actually become a friend of mine on Facebook. So, Art, I think you hit the nail on the head. If Europa, a moon of Jupiter, which James Cameron copied in the movie Avatar, if Europa is a paradigm of the future, and there may be 100, 1,000 times more plentiful than Earth-like rocky planets like ours, then life probably would evolve in a totally different way. First of all, they would evolve underneath the ice, just like Europa in our own solar system. Mm-hmm. These creatures would be aquatic, like dolphins or maybe octopods. They probably wouldn't have eyes because they would evolve underneath the ice. And they probably would use sonar to communicate, sonar to navigate in their underground world underneath the ice. But electronics, you mentioned the dishes and the transmitters and the chips, the computers, electricity does not operate underwater. So their ability to communicate, to build radio dishes and stuff like that would be limited. Eventually, they're going to have to leave the water like we did, you know, half a billion years ago. At some point, they're going to have to leave the water and get onto the surface of their moon so that they can build the radio telescopes and the chips and the computers and build the technology. So it would be more tortuous evolving on Pandora than on the Earth. It would be difficult for them to have electronics until they left the oceans. And the oceans, by the way, are heated up by volcanic forces, which in turn are heated up by tidal forces. The gravity of the Jupiter planet churns the inside of the moon, and that friction causes heat, which then melts the ice and creates an ocean underneath the ice cover.
All right, but why do we even imagine that it would ever evolve technologically or even have to?
Well, we wouldn't have to, but because of the laws of evolution, you know, survival of the fittest, competition, you have an advantage. If you have a large brain and you can strategize and eventually develop tools, you have a survival value. Now, remember, the dinosaurs on the Earth lasted for millions and millions of years. None of them ever invented a computer. None of them ever invented electronics. However, you know, we humans are different. We don't have fangs, claws, wings. We don't run very fast. We can't smell very well. We're kind of like an oddball creature. For us, we had to use tools to survive because we didn't have the claws, the wings, and the running ability and the swimming ability that animals do. So our advantage was the big brain. So you can imagine on a Europa that maybe there's an aquatic species that's, you know, very poorly adapted. It has to evolve a brain in order to compete with all the sharks and all the gigantic octopods that swim inside that ocean. So that would then drive technology, a large brain.
Professor, I'm curious, what are the latest statistics based on what we've discovered? As you pointed out, we've been discovering Earth-like possibilities out there, certainly lots and lots of planets. Big ones to begin with, but we know the smaller ones are out there. So there must be some modern stats on how many possibilities there are or may be out there for life.
That's right. We actually have an encyclopedia now. We have so much statistics. We have an encyclopedia of these extrasolar planets, about 400 of them so far observed orbiting other stars in the universe. Almost every star we look at, we find some Jupiter-like object orbiting around it. We find them at the rate of about once a week or once every 2 weeks. We discover a new Jupiter-sized planet. And as you correctly pointed out, our instruments are so crude and primitive, we can only pick out the Jupiters. We can't pick out the Earth-like planets yet. And that's where Kepler comes in. Kepler is designed to find maybe up to 600 Earth-like twins in outer space. The French have a Corot satellite. It actually picks up an object twice the size of the Earth. That's the world's record so far. The record is an object twice the size of the Earth, and it actually has water on it. This is amazing. It actually has water on it, but it's too hot to sustain life as we know it. It's steam, basically. It's a steam planet, a planet with lots of hot steam circulating around. But it's about twice the size of the Earth. And so we're getting very close now to snagging a twin of the Earth. In fact, I think this year or perhaps next year, when the first Kepler results are announced, we may actually make the historic announcement that we have found a twin of the Earth in outer space with liquid water about the same size as the Earth, with liquid oceans. And water is the universal solvent. It's the amniotic fluid of life. That's where DNA got off the ground because, you know, DNA dissolves in water. So, wait for it. Sometime this year or next year, we could make this historic announcement that we have found a twin in space.
I guess, boy, wouldn't that be something? I guess that's important for life to evolve as we know it or imagine it. But on these other planets and these other bodies, it's certainly possible for life to evolve not as we know it.
Right.
But with different physics altogether.
Right. Well, they're not going to want to eat us or mate with us, I don't think, because they're going to have different DNA and different molecules. However, they are probably going to be carbon-based. Carbon has four bonds, and as a consequence, you can make graphite, diamonds, hydrocarbons, people out of carbon, because it has a rich chemistry with four bonds. It's like Tinker Toys. You can make lots of Tinker Toys with an object with four joints on it. However, other chemicals with four bonds are kind of rare. Silicon has four bonds, but silicon's compounds, many of them are not water-soluble. Transistors are made out of silicon. Sand is made out of silicon. Many of the compounds are not water-soluble. So carbon is ideal. It's water-soluble, and it has four bonds, and you string them together, and they're called proteins. So life could have spontaneously been created, perhaps in the bottom of the oceans, near volcano vents. That's one theory as to where life originally came from, volcano vents on the bottom of our oceans. And that may be repeated in outer space, but the DNA is going to be different. It's not going to be like our DNA. We're not going to want to eat them. They're not going to want to eat us as a consequence.
Good. How do we ever get there? Or how do they ever get here? They're going to be so far away. They're going to be light years and light years away. Unless we can breach the speed of light, is just too far.
Right. That's where the so-called giggle factor comes in. You talk to a scientist about extraterrestrials reaching the Earth, and most scientists start to giggle at that point. Well, I don't giggle, because if you look at Einstein's equations very carefully, when he said he can't go faster than the speed of light, recently we found a loophole that has created quite a bit of shockwaves within the scientific community. The loophole is, if you throw in something called negative matter or negative energy, then Einstein's equations turn inside out. And all of a sudden, instead of being slower than the speed of light, you can go faster than the speed of light.
Really?
So let's say you want to walk across a room with a carpet. You can go the old-fashioned way and walk across a carpet. Or you can compress the carpet in front of you, compress it, rope it, and drag a table next to you, and then just hop across the folded carpet. So if you can compress space in front of you, expand space behind you, then that's warp drive. Or if you drill a hole in the carpet, you can take a shortcut, and that's called a wormhole. So there are two loopholes in Einstein's equations if you use what is called negative matter, negative energy, to either compress space or to drill a hole through space, and that's called a wormhole.
Or effectively bend space.
That's right. We're bending space either by curling it up, compressing it in the forward direction, expanding it in the backward direction, or actually drilling a hole right through the carpet, a shortcut, and that's called a wormhole. And by the way, on the TV series that I host, Sci-Fi Science, on the Science Channel, every Tuesday at 10, it airs. It's a weekly show. And we actually animated this process. We actually brought in physicists from Princeton and different places, and we showed with animation how a warp drive engine would look like. And we actually built, using graphics, a hypothetical warp drive engine on the program.
Again, that's the Science Channel. Sci-fi channel, right?
Or Discovery
Tuesday,
Channel.
Tuesday night at 10.
Tuesday night at 10. In the United States, it's on the Science Channel. In Asia, it's going to be on the Discovery Channel.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so if that theoretically could be done, perhaps it's already been done. I mean, there are many, as you know, who say they're here now, or they've been here. Isn't that in the world of probabilities, after all?
Yes. Now, exotic matter, that is negative matter, negative energy, are extremely difficult to get. We've only made microscopic quantities of this on the Earth. In fact, we took a TV camera to Harvard University, where they actually make tiny quantities of negative energy, microscopic quantities. You need to harvest like planet-size, moon-size, moon-size amounts of negative matter in order to, you know, drive these time machines. And once I was asked by Popular Mechanics to theorize about Lost, the TV series Lost, what could possibly create these bizarre anomalies on the Earth. And, you know, I watched a few episodes of Lost, and the way you could do it is by having a negative matter meteorite, a meteorite made out of negative matter, plow into an island, and then you would have bizarre distortions of space and time taking place. And you're using reputable physics as a consequence. Now, again, we've never seen large quantities of negative matter or negative energy. It'd be quite exotic. If I held negative matter in my hand, it would fall up. It wouldn't fall down. It would have anti-gravitational properties. And you just stick it into Einstein's equations, and bingo, you know, warp drive, time travel, all the weird stuff in Twilight Zone becomes a consequence. Now, an alien civilization far ahead of us may be able to create their own negative energy or negative matter. We do it on the Earth already in microscopic quantities. So it's conceivable that an advanced civilization may harvest large quantities of it. And then you're talking business.
Hmm. Such an advanced civilization would be capable then of traveling to Earth and doing so at greater than the speed of light. So easily they could have been here, or they could be here now, and they could be observing. Is this something the Royal Society of England is considering?
Actually, yes. One of my friends, Paul Davies, at the conference has floated the idea that if you look at the movie 2001, that movie says they're already here. They're robotic, and they're on the moon, like a virus. A virus propagates by landing on a cell, hijacking the DNA machinery and creating copies of itself, and they infect other cells. And in 2 weeks, you get a cold. You're sneezing, and it all started from a molecule called one virus.
That's right.
That's the way to explore the galaxy, not Captain Kirk. Captain Kirk and the Enterprise is the silliest way to explore the galaxy. The easiest way is to have robots that land on the moon, create a factory, and then the factory creates copies of itself, and then thousands more probes then scatter, creating an exponential chain reaction. So starting with one probe, you get thousands, then millions, then billions and trillions. That's the way to explore the galaxy. So if a passing civilization were to come through our solar system, they would have left something on the moon. Moon has no erosions, quite stable on the moon, no water, no rust on the moon. And they're probably just sitting there observing us. That's a possibility you can't rule out. And that's a possibility being
something
discussed.
Something like the obelisk, yeah.
Now, that's a possibility being discussed right now in London.
Well, certainly we're at least rare here on Earth. I mean, based on our own observations, we're fairly rare. I mean, one would think we would, by a very advanced society, be noticed. We're rare. There's lots of us. We have lots of emanations of television and radio and radar and microwave. And so one would think that we would be noticed. And if we've been noticed and they can travel here, it's reasonable to assume they've either been here or are here now, or as you point out, maybe on the moon observing. And I wonder how they would look at us, or whether they would look at us as, well, I don't know, a virus that they're about to get or might get.
Well, first of all, I don't think they're going to want to conquer us to steal our minerals, because there are plenty of planets out there with minerals that have no natives that will be rebellious. And so I think there's plenty of planets to mine other than the Earth. So there's really nothing that we have that would interest them. They're not going to want to mate with us or perform experiments on us or eat us, because the DNA is going to be totally different. And so for the most part, I think they would ignore us. We think we're so great that they're going to want to come down to us and give us technology and advanced medicine and so on and so forth. But, you know, why? You know, if you read Douglas Adams, the science fiction writer, he said that if a civilization is that advanced, what we have to worry about is that we're going to get paved over. If you're an animal like a deer or a mountain lion in a forest, the danger that humans put on you is not that they're going to eat you. That's not what animals fear from us. What they fear the most is they're going to get paved over, that they're not even on the radar screen. We just want to pave them over to build a shopping mall in their habitat. That's what animals are afraid of if they understood what was really happening. So the fear that we would have is not that they're going to want to eat us, invade us, conquer us. The fear is that, A, they're going to ignore us, or, B, they'll pave us over.
Pave us over. That's something to consider. Okay, well, regarding transportation, what about, since we're with movies, you must have seen Jumper, right?
Yeah, great movie.
Yeah, it was a great movie. Teleportation. So that might be one mode of transportation for them, what we call teleportation, yes?
That's right. We physicists used to laugh whenever someone talked about teleportation and invisibility and stuff like that. We don't laugh anymore. We realize that we were wrong on this one. Quantum teleportation already exists. In fact, you know, for the Science Channel, we took a film crew and we went to the University of Maryland and filmed an atom being teleported, zap, right across the room from one chamber to another chamber over a distance of about, 5 feet. So at the atomic level, we do it already. It's called quantum entanglement. Two atoms that are vibrating in synchronization, you know, they're beating back and forth at the same rate. If you separate them, there's an umbilical cord that connects them. This is very strange, very bizarre, defies common sense, but hey, that's just the way the world is. There is an umbilical cord connecting these two twins, and anything that happens to one twin happens to the other twin actually faster than the speed of light. So you can have these twins sort of like know of each other's presence, and that's the principle by which we use quantum teleportation to zap objects. Now, when we do quantum teleportation, it travels slower than the speed of light, so Einstein still has the last laugh on this one. But we do it now on the atomic level. Cesium atoms, rubidium atoms have already been teleported. I think within a decade, we'll teleport the first molecule.
So, but that's not the way a scientist is supposed to speak. You know, in other words, say, that's the way the world is. You know, that's just an insufficient explanation for the apparent impossible communication that's occurring between these two things. It's just there has to be some kind of communication, but there is no discernible communication. They do their flips and flops together without talking to each other, and just to say that's the way the world is, well, that's just not enough, or it shouldn't be, for a scientist.
Yeah, well, you know, if you want to see a physicist blush, ask him the origin of the quantum theory. The quantum theory is the most bizarre, incredible, phantasmagoric theory ever proposed. Objects can disappear, reappear someplace else. Objects could be two places at the same time. All these are considered nonsense. The sentences that I just uttered are totally nonsense. You cannot be two places at the same time. You cannot disappear, reappear someplace else. But electrons do that all the time. It's called transistors. Light does it all the time. It's called the laser beam. Why is the laser beam so weird? It's precisely
Professor, you can't prove it, and yet you know it happens. You can't prove it, and yet you know it happens. That's, well, you know, that's almost like faith, isn't it? Yeah. just like faith, something you can't prove and yet you know is true. That's faith. It is all the way from Manila in the Philippines, Southeast Asia. It's an amazing thing in itself, folks, that we can do a radio program, a four-hour radio program from one side of the world to the other. It amazes me. And I'm, you know, sort of technological, but it totally blows me away. And I think Premier is the only company in the world that I'm aware of that even endeavors to do such a thing. You get little reports and things like that from one side of the world to the other. But a four-hour interactive talk show from the other side of the world, that's pretty much exclusively Premier's territory. I'm Art Bell for George Norrie with Dr. Michio Kaku, and we'll be right back. Faith is not normally a word associated with the lexicon of science, but really, it has to come down to that quantum faith, Professor. These two particles are going vertical and horizontal, and vertical and horizontal, and they're doing this together, always, without any discernible communication between them that we can find, and or even perhaps more mysteriously, there is no communication between these particles taking place. It's one or the other. Either way, it's truly mysterious, and it boils down to faith that something's happening that we don't understand, right?
Well, you're getting very close to the truth, because this is a huge gap in our understanding of the quantum world. We physicists use the quantum theory like a cookbook. We can read that cookbook. You put a little silicon, you put a little transistor, you put a wire, and bingo, you have a chip. We know how to make chips. We know how to make iPods and the internet and so on and so forth. But we don't understand why it works that way. There's a hole, a philosophical hole there. In the quantum theory, not only do we have this umbilical cord between two objects that are beating in unison, we also have objects that disappear, reappear someplace else, objects that can be many places at the same time. And these are electrons. These are photons inside a laser beam. The gross domestic product of the Earth depends on the quantum theory. You turn off the quantum theory, all the satellites blink out, the internet stops, lasers don't work anymore. You know, we're throwing back hundreds of years into the past without the quantum theory. But we don't know why it works. Einstein didn't like the theory at all. He called it spooky action at a distance is how Einstein called it. He didn't like God throwing dice. Well, you know, get used to it. God throws dice. I mean, what can I say?
No. All right, so these two particles flip polarity together. Now, is there any way at all to measure at a great distance this spookiness? Is it occurring faster than the speed of light?
Well, the world's record right now is that we've been able to teleport photons, particles of light, across the Danube River in Austria. So at the University of Vienna, in fact, some of the people there may eventually win the Nobel Prize for this. They've been able to zap particles of light right across, right under, in fact, the Danube River in Austria. And now they're thinking about doing it into outer space with a space shuttle. Perhaps we'll be able to zap photons from the Earth to the space shuttle. That's what they're thinking about next, over a distance of maybe 300 miles into outer space. And maybe one day when we go to Mars, they even say, maybe we'll teleport objects to Mars this way. The teleportation process of matter takes place slower than the speed of light. Slower than the speed of light. But this weird bond between objects that are vibrating in phase, like an umbilical cord, that travels faster than the speed of light, okay? Einstein didn't like that. He said, my theory of relativity is wrong. But it turns out Einstein has the last laugh. It turns out that the information that travels faster than light is random information. Real information, like Morse code, atoms that vibrate in a certain specific way, giving you a radio, that travels slower than the speed of light. Mm-hmm. But the actual interactions travel faster than light, but that's random information. You can't send rock and roll music via this way. It's random information that goes faster than light. But slower than light is not so bad. Slower than light, we can teleport atoms, we can teleport photons, and pretty soon molecules, maybe eventually Captain Kirk.
But still, Professor, even though it's random information, it's still information.
That's right, but it's not like Morse code. You can't send a signal faster than light this way. Look at it this way. If you put on two socks in the morning, one sock is green and the other sock is red, and you mix it together. One day you lift up one pants and it's green. How fast did you know that the other pants was red? You knew that faster than the speed of light. But it's not usable information. You can't send Morse code this way. So if you know that one electron is spinning up, you know that on the other side of the galaxy, faster than the speed of light, there's another atom spinning down, such that the two cancel out. So you now know something about the other side of the galaxy faster than the speed of light, but you can't send Morse code this way. You can't send usable information. You can't send rock and roll music this way.
Hmm.
Otherwise, we'd be able to communicate with aliens from outer space.
All right, let's talk about aliens that might be a little closer. Many, many, many people, yourself included, I believe, theorize that we may have other dimensions. Now, mm-hmm. that would mean perhaps that there could be another or perhaps many simultaneous worlds all around us, happening around us all the time. It's mm-hmm. just separated by a dimension that could be, I suppose, very thin.
That's right. And it's sort of like, two sheets of paper with ants living on each sheet of paper, living their mm-hmm. life, not realizing that just right next to them, there's another sheet of paper right on top of them where they inhabit. H.G. Wells, the science fiction writer, loved this idea. When he wrote the book, The Invisible Man, it was the fourth dimension that made the Invisible Man invisible. Hollywood gets it all wrong. Read the original Invisible Man, and you realize that it's the fourth dimension that makes an object invisible. You hover right over mm-hmm. our universe. Light travels beneath the Invisible Man, and that's why he's invisible. Now, in the old days, we physicists used to laugh talking about these higher dimensions, you know, like Twilight Zone. But we don't laugh anymore. Like I mentioned, the Large Hadron Collider, we think that one set of experiments may actually reveal the presence of another parallel universe. This is serious business now. An 11 billion euro machine. One of its purposes is to look for these higher dimensions. And string theory, which is what I do for a living, that's my day job. String theory says there could be 10, 11 dimensions, not just three, but maybe up to 11 dimensions. And the Big Bang was a bang that resonated through 11 dimensions, not just the three dimensions that we're familiar with. So this is big business now. We're not laughing about these higher dimensions and parallel universes anymore. Maybe this is ourselves.
Out of curiosity, Professor, yeah. Why 11? Why 11?
It turns out that if you look at 12, 13 dimensions, the equations become unstable. They decay down to 11 dimensions. Now, there is a theory at Harvard where you have two times. You have 10 dimensions of space and two dimensions of time. That's called a double-time universe, and that is a 12-dimensional universe. It seems to be equivalent to string theory. String theory does have a 12-dimensional extension. But when you go to 13 dimensions, the theory becomes unstable. Mathematically, it falls apart, and then it decays down to 11 or 10 dimensions.
Well, you're sure right about one thing. A lot of the things that you were chuckling about just years ago, mm-hmm. in fact, with me on this program, you're not chuckling about anymore.
This is big business, very serious. We now have a machine that can actually test a lot of these bizarre theories right out of the Twilight Zone. So this is something that we take very seriously now. So parallel universes, we think that could explain the Big Bang. The Big Bang, in fact, may have been a collision between these bubbles. Think of our universe as a bubble. We live on the skin of the bubble. We're like flies trapped on flypaper. We can't escape the bubble. The bubble's expanding. That's the Big Bang theory of Einstein. But there are other bubbles out there, other bubbles, other universes, giving us a bubble bath. The new paradigm is the multiverse. We think there could be many bubbles out there. And sometimes these bubbles bump into each other. That's called the Big Splat theory. Other time, these bubbles fission in half. That's called inflationary theory. And these bubbles bud other bubbles and split and reform. That's the multiverse. That is now the dominant paradigm that quantum cosmology delves into.
Is the Royal Society of England having any discussions, perhaps little sidebars, on the protocols that they would imagine or might think about for contact with another civilization?
That's right. If it happens, and who knows when, but it could happen in our lifetime. It could happen in our children's lifetime. That could be one of the most pivotal events in the history of the human race. And it could happen either in our lifetime or our kids' lifetimes. However, the protocols are actually being debated in London. What do you do? What do you do if you pick up a transmission, a love letter, or a declaration of war, or whatever, from another civilization? And there's debates about it. Some people say that we should make it public immediately. My attitude is that's not a good idea, because that's going to set off panic. I mean, as Arthur C. Clarke once said, either there's intelligent beings in outer space or there's not. Either thought is frightening. And I think a lot of people are going to get really upset if we all of a sudden eavesdrop on, you know, an advanced civilization. I would prefer that, you know, scientists study it for a while, figure out how advanced are these people? I mean, what are their intentions? Do they know about us? Are we listening in silently and they don't know about our existence? What do they want? That's what I think we should do first before we make a press conference and tell the United Nations and the world that we've just made contact with alien civilizations. So this question is being debated in London even as we speak.
I really agree with you. Over the years, I've contemplated this a lot. And, of course, there is the old Brookings study, which suggests that religious institutions and other institutions would panic and there'd be crumbling institutions over it. And I tend to think that's at least to some degree correct, and that that information would have to be withheld while, as you mentioned it, it's studied. So conceivably, it could have already occurred and could be a big secret right now.
Well, take a look at the year 1600. In the streets of Rome, Giordano Bruno, a heretical monk, was burned alive in the streets of Rome for saying that there were aliens in outer space. And the Catholic Church was very upset by this idea, because then the question is, do they have, is there a million Jesus Christ in outer space, a billion popes, a trillion saints? How many sins are there in outer space? The mind goes boggling into space when you think about, you know, a billion Jesus Christ in outer space. Do they all have the Trinity and salvation and venial sin and so on and so forth? So the Catholic Church simply burned them alive. And that's how they dealt with the question. Well,
Catholic Church has changed a little bit, Professor. They've got some pretty big observatories, one in Arizona, notably.
And believe it or not, just about 2 months ago, the Vatican sponsored a major, major conference on all these possibilities. Even the Catholic Church is now catching up. They didn't apologize to Giordano Bruno, okay, for burning him alive. However, they had a conference at the Vatican, of all places, looking into visitation possibilities, looking into, you know, what do we do if we make contact with aliens from outer space? They see it coming. Even the Catholic Church realizes by reading the newspapers, if we have discovered 400 planets in outer space, one day we're going to find an Earth-like one. So even the Catholic Church is gearing up for the day when we make contact with an extraterrestrial civilization.
So you think on balance then that all of this, if contact is made or has been made, is being kept secret or should be kept secret?
I think it should be kept secret for a while until we first find out how advanced are they. You know, as I mentioned before, we are a type zero civilization. If they're just type one, it means that maybe they're 100, 200 years ahead of us, and it's not such a big deal. However, if the civilization turns out to be type two, then we're talking about a civilization comparable to Star Trek. They've already colonized a chunk of the galaxy. They have starships. At that point, we might have to worry a little bit. And if they're type three, you're talking about the Borg. You're talking about the Empire of Star Wars. At that point, you really, really have to sit down and wonder, what do they want? I mean, do they want to pave us over, or are we not even on their radar screen? So I think we should study them first and find out how advanced are they, and how do they treat, you know, civilizations like us.
We are a type zero, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. I know we're, I think you've mentioned in the past, we're kind of on the cusp of becoming a type one. What would mark our transition from zero to one?
Well, by definition, a type one civilization can use all the energy that comes from the sun, all of it. We are about 100 years away from becoming a type 1 civilization. A type 1 civilization, for example, can control the weather. Anything planetary, they can control. Cities on the ocean, earthquakes, the tragedy in Haiti. All these things they can control because they control planetary energy. Type 2 is stellar. They can actually control stars, like in Star Trek. And type 3 is galactic, like the Star Wars saga. We are about 100 years away. Like, what is the Internet? The Internet is a type 1 telephone system. We're looking at the beginning of a type 1 language. The type 1 language will be English, probably. 100 years from now, almost all the educated people, the middle class, will be speaking English in about 100 years. And, you know, what is rock and roll? Rock and roll is the beginning of a type 1 culture, youth culture. We're seeing the beginning of a type 1 economy. What is the European Union? These nations have hated each other for 1,000 years. How come they formed the European Union? Because they're competing against us. We are NAFTA. That's why we have the European Union. So we're seeing the beginning of a type 1 economy. So a type 1 culture, a type 1 economy, a type 1 fashion design, for example. Anywhere in the world you go to the fashion centers, you see the same name brands. We're beginning to see the beginning of a type 1 fashion, in fact. So all these signs point to the beginning of a type 1 civilization.
You're pretty sure type 1 language will be English and not Chinese, huh?
Well, if you look at the Internet right now, you can actually calculate how many websites, what language they use. English still edges out Mandarin. But when I travel in Asia, you know, you have a Vietnamese, a Malaysian, a Korean in one room. What do they talk? What language do they speak? And they all speak in English.
It's
and when I go to Europe and there's a German and a Swede and a Finn, and what language do they speak in? They speak in English. So by default, it already is, in some sense, the language of the elites, the educated, the business elites. They all speak English.
Mm-hmm. Quite true. Really true. In fact, this country, the Philippines, the second strong language here is English. Everything here is printed in English. All the signs that you read, everything is printed in English.
Yeah. So I think in the future, a type 1 civilization will be bicultural. That is, we'll have our own local traditions, we'll have our own local language, and that'll be on the Internet. But there'll also be a planetary culture. And we already see that in the elites. Any society you go to, the elites are already bicultural. They speak English, they get all the English newspapers, whatever. But locally, they speak the local language. So I think the middle class will eventually become bicultural. They'll have their own middle class culture, but they'll also be fluent in the type 1 culture of the earth itself. So everywhere I look, I see the beginning of a type 1 civilization. However, as we mentioned before, it's not guaranteed that we'll even reach it.
Actually, far, far, far from guaranteed. I remember you giving me the odds of us getting to type 1.
It's a little frightening.
Very depressing. Actually, depressing.
You know, when we go to outer space and visit other civilizations, maybe we'll see atmospheres that are radioactive and they had a nuclear war, or atmospheres that are too hot and they let the greenhouse effect get out of control. Maybe that's the reason why we don't easily pick up radiation signals, radio signals from these nearby planets, because maybe they never made it to type 1. That's a problem. You know, it's not guaranteed that we're going to reach type 1.
By the way, you still think we are warming up, global warming, right?
Yeah, I think even former President George W. Bush toward the end was saying, well, yeah, hey, something is happening. Something big is happening to the earth. Even he was saying that, yeah, it looks like the earth is heating up and maybe we had something to play in it, right? He didn't say it definitely, but, you know, the United Nations panel, thousands of climatologists point the finger at human activity. And
now, all this, you still believe it now, despite the controversial email business that went on.
And also, by the way, the latest scandal, this is scandalous, is that there's one paragraph.
Hold it right there. We're at a break point. When you mention the latest scandal, that's a great place to hang people up. That's what we do in radio, and we hang them up. So in a moment. The latest scandal, whatever it is, as you know, we did have an email scandal about global warming. A lot of people said, see, it's all nonsense, but keeps getting warmer and warmer and warmer. I'm Art Bell.